And so today is Sunday afternoon. It looks like it were evenly split. Well, hello, Carl. Glad to see you join us.
Nice to be with you. How's it going?
Oh, we're about to start a topic today that has to do with the twins of belief and trust. Okay, so let's take them each one and separately and then see if we can put them together. That in fact, belief and trust are often the same thing. And that they're both founded in ignorance. In the sense that we believe things that we have been told by others. And one of the things that we have been told by others is to trust what they're saying, or another way of saying it is to believe what they're saying. And that often we can understand really that investigation of what is real, reality, is what we can only trust in. But that trust is always temporary and needs to be done again and again and again. So I'm off now on to the point of don't trust anybody with anything and don't believe anything. Don't believe anything and don't trust anything. And there's many things that I can say about that. The first thing that I will say is that any religion, a cloister, a monastery, a mosque, a wat, they all have something in common. And that is people go to those places out of need, almost sometimes out of desperation. So don't trust anybody at a wat. Let's look at it like this, that a wat, a monastery, a holy place, is actually very much like a hospital. And the hospital has three kinds of people. It has the sick and the families of the sick. They have the doctors and the nurses, and then they have the staff, okay? Janitors, cleaners, organizers, administrators, lawyers, accountants, people who are after money. They're not, in fact, most of the people who work at a hospital are not interested in people getting well. They're interested in making a profit off of them. And that's true in every hospital. And it is also kind of true of doctors. And it's also true of Watts. I kind of wish that Kat was on the call right now, in the sense that many of the meditation teachers and many of the people who are called Achan are in it for their own benefit, not for the benefit of the students, but for the benefit of being famous. I saw that in India many, many times. It's called guru worship. And the gurus want to be worshipped, and then all the guru worshipers want to be a guru so they can be worshipped. So you can see now then that those who come to the hospital, in fact, everybody that goes to a hospital belongs in a hospital in one way or another, because they're all sick. And that the hope is that we can, in fact, cure ourselves and cure each other along the way. But along the way also, there is going to be danger. All right? And let's use the example of Catholic priests. because they have been, let us say, noteworthy over the past few years, especially in Boston, but also problems in Australia and problems in the Vatican and problems in Ireland, etc., like that, is because the priest, the young man who becomes a priest, does so for a reason. No man is going to become a priest because he's already qualified as an excellent priest. None of them do. They all come broken. The same thing is true with the Watt. All Watts attract young men to come to the Watt because the guys who come to the Watt and perhaps want to ordain do it for a reason. They want to get unbroken. They want to get unharmed. And in the process of getting ourselves unraveled, we often ravel up other people in it. The whole possible way of looking at it, we can boil all of this stuff down to just one word, and that is in the Pali, ajiva, and that's translated as ignorance. But we have to understand that there's two kinds of ignorance. There is wise ignorance, which means you know that you don't know. And then there is the ordinary kind of ignorance that we can call delusion, denial. In other words, we're ignorant because we're not paying attention and we think we know what's going on when in fact we don't. Freud used the word subconscious. He was being kind of, let us say, gracious when he used the word subconscious. What that actually means is that we go around doing things and are not really aware of what we're doing. So let's say, painting a picture back to the priest and the altar boys, we can see that that happens also in Thailand. It happens in every culture. We all are raised in a society, worldwide society, that puts a twin issue, almost like the two sides of a vice. And then we turn that handle and the two pieces come together squeezing us. Okay, what are the two sides of the vice? One is that sensual pleasure is pleasurable. What's the other side of the vice is? You should not do that because it's dangerous. Okay? And that what we can say is historically, medical science has not been doing its job in relation to sexuality. And so what has happened over the many centuries is that another group has stepped in to fill the job that medical science could not do. Because medical science couldn't do its business, religion stepped in and says, okay, we'll handle the problem. That's why all religions get so hung up on sex, is because it's none of their business and it should be handled medically. Well, now in our modern times, medical science is beginning to wake up and beginning to do its job in the sense of surgery, abortions, the morning after pills, contraceptives, all kinds of things. Now, we also have to point out in this regard that the Buddha's mother died almost in childbirth. It was within a week of him being born that she died. And so you can see that as a young man, he was pretty well hung up about that too, as well as the culture that the Buddha was raised in was pretty well hung up about it. And so we all get hung up in the issues of sensuality and sexuality because we love it so much. and we want it so much that, in fact, there's a whole lot of stuff about it in our society, in the sense that it makes us a man. It creates our manhood, or it proves that we're worthy. That, in fact, the young teenager who gets laid, then all of his friends make a big celebration out of it. Now, in some ancient cultures, they had a rite of passage. You could see how that rite of passage got started in very primitive times, when life was short, and that the men went hunting and the women went gathering, giving us a hunting and gathering mentality. And the little children, the little boys, would stay with their mothers and go gathering with them until a certain age. And I would say that that age generally is about the age of 6 years old. There's something magical about six, and everybody knows it. That's why we start school at the age of six. What is school? School is actually preparing one for adulthood. So at the age, young age of six, these young boys would go out hunting with the men. And that became a kind of a rite of passage, especially when the boy becomes successful in the hunt, either helping or actually capturing an animal. You can fast forward that into more modern times, and you can recognize that this is what the bar mitzvah or bar mitzvah is for the Jewish culture. Is it's a rite of passage that says, okay, you've done a ceremony, now you're a man. In the American Indian tradition, and to be honest with you, I'm a quarter American Indian. I'm not sure exactly what tribe it was, but I have spent some time with the Tuscaroras in there's a big Tuscarora reservation, a huge property in New York State. And I spent quite a lot of time there, as well as being born in Oklahoma. And so I hold dear some of the stuff that the American Indian traditions hold. And various tribes would have various issues that they would resolve that had to do with when is a young man a man. And that one of the things that the Tuscaroras would do is they would send a young boy out into the wilderness with nothing but a knife. And if he comes home within 30 days, he fails. If he doesn't come at all, he fails because he got killed. But his whole point is that you've got to spend 30 days out in the wilderness all on your own. And when you do that, you come back, you're now a man. You're in the tribe, okay? Well, if you look at modern culture, there are a few substitutes for that. One of them is getting married, graduating from high school or college or something, going to the military, and yet none of them are based upon real survival and real success. And so they're artificial. And because of that, most of the people in our human culture nowadays are not really ever sure whether they're a man yet or not, or a full adult or not. Then, in fact, with women, it's often the sign is that she bears children. Until a woman bears children, she's still a girl. She's not a woman yet. And so we want to postpone having babies. We want to postpone having to go out to the wilderness to spend 30 days to make sure that we can survive on our own. We would rather take the easy way out, but that easy way out always leaves us in great doubt about who we are. And can I survive? And so our culture now is based upon generation of generation after generation of adults who are not quite sure they're really adults yet, raising children who then grow up to be not really full adults yet. So in a way, our cultures do not prepare us for adulthood. This is one of the reasons why we like certain kind of movies like Jack Reacher or Gunslingers. All of this kind of movie is when people are out proving their manhood or proving that they can, let us say, survive. But there's also this issue about sexuality, because that's often used as a substitute to prove who we are. And that goes on top of biological urges. And so our cultures actually support bad behavior, because people are trying to prove to themselves who they are, what they are, et cetera, like that. And that I can introduce now the point of Anapanasati, that the job of the practice of meditation is to continue to practice over and over again until you talk yourself into and actually understand that you are now an adult. You have grown up. You are no longer a child subject to a parent. And yet very few people ever reach that stage. Most of us, in fact, go around looking for parents. When we're in college, we look at college professors as a parent. We look at police as a parent. We look at governments as a parent to take care of us. We're always looking for someone to take care of us, even in the spiritual world, when we're actually trying to become adults. We still look for gurus. We look for teachers. We look for someone to help us. That, in fact, this is basically what I'm talking about, is the primary doubt that we are unsure of ourselves. We want help. This is why religions have gods, is because the God is the ultimate parent, is going to save you, because you can't save yourself. You're not a man yet. So we have all of these things, and when we become, let us say, spiritually oriented, the first thing that we have to get over is, who's going to help me? I need a Jesus. I need a teacher. I need a guru. I need someone to show me the way. Not just show me the way, take me. Not just show me the way and take me, but let me crawl on his back and ride, because I can't do the journey myself. Go ahead, Dietrich. You got your hand up.
I was wondering what you would define as being an adult. Is that being really responsible for your own mind,
Let us then make that distinction as the fact that when each child is born, we are born in a culture that supports the young. When children, when human children are born, they can't use their hands, they can't walk, they can't feed themselves. About the best thing we can do is suck. The first thing that we do is we suck and we beller, and we spend partially the rest of our lives sucking and bellering. That's what we do. And those two things are the mark of a victim. The victim is the one who needs help. And the whole story of the spiritual journey is to come out of that doubt about who can I get to help me, because I can't do it myself. When we come to the point of, I can do it, that's the second one. The first one is that we come to the position that is nobody going to help me. Everybody that I talk to is as screwed up as I am. I can find a guru, but if you inspect very closely the guru, you find he's got clay feet too. You have to understand that your teachers, and you know, guys, that I have a huge amount of respect for Bhikkhu Buddhadasa and a huge amount of respect for Achan Po. But they too have clay feet. They too have ways for me to see that they're not the idol that I wanted them to be. Everyone is human. Everyone has faults and fallacies. And so becoming a perfect person is not what we're talking about here. What we're talking about instead is an attitude change. The change of attitude from being a sucker, of being a victim, of needing help, needing a teacher, needing a guru, into the position of nobody's going to help me. Okay, and so we can look at the darker side for just a second in the sense that those priests do not understand that the altar boy cannot help them. And the altar boy could not help the priest, but the priest cannot help the altar boy. That in fact, it's going to be an issue of abuse rather than real mentoring. So that's what's happening. We're all hospital patients. And when we go to the Watt, that's our hospital. But in fact, I've owned that position for a long, long time. So whenever you go to a Watt, a temple, a place of worship, whatever your bag is, recognize that everybody that you'll meet is there for the same reason that you are. They want something. And when can we change our attitude from I need help into I'm not going to get any help? I'm on my own here. We started last week sometime talking about Mahayana and Hinayana. Basically, what the Mahayana is that staying in that position of, I need help. I need someone to have a big boat that I can ride in. And the teaching of the Buddha is basically, nobody's going to help you. You're on your own. This is why he defines the Four Noble Truths the way that he does about the cause of dukkha, the cause of suffering, the cause of dissatisfaction, is something that happens inside of our own mind. And no one can crawl in there with a scalpel, a knife, wisdom, and fix the darn thing. Now, a piano teacher can listen to the piano student play and make recommendations. But in the meditation hall on retreats, people are sitting there and no one, not the guru, not the teacher, not the Vipassana expert, can crawl inside of anyone's mind and know what's going on in there. You're all on your own. And that's the first doubt that we have to get through. And look at how much trouble we have in the world because people cannot come to that position. So you'll have sexual abuse, you'll have desire, you'll have hoochie-goochie shows, and everybody that goes to a hoochie-goochie show wants something. No one goes there because they're already the boss of their own life. No one goes to a Wat, a monastery, a church, a mosque, because they're already whole. In fact, that's one of the points about the Arahats is the Arahats, they don't want to be around. There's a very famous story about a Christian many, many centuries ago, and this was part of the Coptic. He was in Ethiopia someplace. And he got tired of all of the people who were worshiping him as a guru in the temple that he was at. And so he goes and he builds himself a little kuti, a little hut, high on the hill, quite a walk away from the temple that he was in. And over a course of time, some of his students would go and build their own little hut fairly close to him. And pretty soon it became a community that was away from the community. And what did he do then? He left there too. And he went even further up on the mountain. Why? Because he didn't want to deal with everybody else's troubles. That takes someone who's pretty good at dealing with problems, and they're really excellent at solving them. That's where you come in with the Buddha, because the Buddha made the point is that the stuff that he has to teach is difficult. It's profound. It is exactly upside down and opposite to the way that everybody in the world views things. And then he says, it's really not worth teaching because nobody's going to get the point. And then he said, well, maybe some of my teachers, and he went through Alaka Lama and Ramaputta. And that he recognized that these guys, the ones who he thought could actually get it, were already dead. And so he said, well, maybe the guys that I've been hanging out with for the past 6 years, they'll understand. And that's why he went from Bodh Gaya to Isatania, which is the Deer Park, which is, you know, 30, 40 kilometer hike. He didn't fly through the air. He wasn't that kind of dude. He walked. And that was the beginning. So the Buddha was very special in the sense that he knew how difficult the teachings were to get across to people, and he was willing to do it anyway. He was willing to be in the world, but not of it. And those kind of people are quite rare. Almost all of the teachers, all of the spiritual teachers, are in it for themselves. They want something. They get some benefit out of it. To be honest with you, I do these talks because I enjoy talking. I enjoy teaching. I enjoy doing this. And I don't have to put up with a bunch of students who were shooting arrows back. They do on the comments sometimes, but generally, I'm easy. I don't have to deal with criticisms. So this whole point then is that we are actually all on our own, and no one is going to save us. So here's the Buddha out teaching that very thing. He's out there saving people by telling them the second noble truth. You're on your own. You're not going to find a guru. You're not going to find anybody to help you. You got to do it yourself. And when we come to that position, we begin to look at the whole situation really a lot differently. What is the difference is that we don't go looking for love in all the wrong places. I love that song. Looking for love in all the wrong places. Guess what? When we're out looking for love, they're the only place to look for it is in the wrong places. If you're looking for love, you're guaranteed to not find it. It's only when you recognize that you're on your own and any love that you have, you're going to have to manufacture that stuff out of whole cloth. Actually, you don't even have cloth. You're going to have to go peel that tree and get some bark and make the cloth and then manufacture your love. Because you don't have any equipment for that at all. So this is actually the practice of Anapanasati. But once we get over that one point that nobody can save us, that brings up the second question, which is an even tougher question. And that is the question of, am I up to the task of growing up all on my own? Because nobody I know has grown up. Can I do it on my own? That's the main question. And so this is what really takes the practice. The Anapanasati really starts kicking in at this level. Why? Because we start giving ourselves tasks to do that we are capable of doing. The mind is just all over the place. It changes. They call it a monkey mind. Freud called it free association, that the mind just jumps around. So the real easy thing to do is to start to teach the mind where to jump. Because it's already able to jump. The hard part of jumping has already been done. So the easy part then is to figure out that we can aim for where we're going to jump. And this is right effort. This is recognize what is unwholesome, jumping in the wrong direction, and start jumping into the right direction, start jumping into wholesome thoughts. And if we keep doing this over and over again, the first thing we're going to recognize is that I jumped right and it's the first time, but now I jumped wrong again. And so I'll jump right and then I jump wrong again. Oh, poor me, I can't control the jumping yet. Not very well, only occasionally. This is actually why Goenka talks about that when the mind wanders away from the breath, never mind, start again. Because that's jumping in the right direction. Just never mind, start again. But we often beat ourselves up. We often complain, oh, the mind wandered away. You jumped in the wrong direction. And so there's going to be a lot of jumping in the wrong direction while we're learning to jump in the right direction. But if we keep practicing, we'll start to get better at it. And pretty soon we can jump in the right direction and jump in the right direction over and over again. And now we begin to gain confidence that we actually can jump in the right direction. This is an important part. This is actually in the Pali, is called Samasankappa, and it has a twin called Shraddha or Shraddha. By the way, the Shraddha part is Sanskrit, but it's the same word. Sada and Shraddha mean competence. It does not mean faith. But in fact, faith is what a victim needs, that the guru or the God or the plastic Jesus is going to help you. That's faith. We've already beyond faith. There is no faith. You're stuck. No help available. The door is closed. You're going to have to find a way of breaking in. So that reminds me actually of a story. This is a Zen story. And that it starts off with a Zen monk reading a book. And in that book, he reads a story about a guy who wanted to get into the temple, but the temple door was closed. And so what this guy did was is he sat outside the door waiting for it to get open. And after that, he stayed there. He opened a food stall, and he spent most of his life in front of the door of that temple waiting for the door to open. And he'd go knock on that door, and he'd scratch on it, and he'd yell, and he'd bang on it, and the door never opened. And when he was a really, really old man, finally, the door opened, just a crack. And the guy behind the door says, "The door is closed," and then he slams it shut. Well, the guy that was reading this book, the Zen dude, he doesn't know what to do about this. And so he goes to his teacher and explains the story to him. And the teacher says, "Okay, you come with me." And so he took him to the wat, you know, the big temple door, the dojo, whatever. And just as the teacher went through the door, as the student was about to go through the door, the teacher slams the door shut. And that was the awakening of this guy, to recognize that the door that you're trying to get open is not available to you. There is no help available. You're on your own. And all I can do is tell you stories. One of these days, I'm going to shut the door in somebody's face to teach them a lesson. But right now, all I have are these stories to tell to make sure that you understand that you're on your own. But you can do it on your own. But you have to stop trying to get that door open and go find your peace of mind someplace else. Because we've been looking at it in love for all the wrong places. We've been looking in sexuality. We've been looking in sexuality. We've been looking in marriage. We've been looking at drugs. We've been looking at alcohol. We've been looking at gurus and teachers and all kinds of places to find that love. And it's not available. So the question now is, are you up to the task of growing up all on your own? And the answer to that is, those are skills that have to be developed. And look how much time we have spent trying to get somebody else to do our job for us. And we're on our own. We got to do it ourselves. Deidre, you got a question?
Yeah, it makes me wonder about being a good teacher is not about saving people. Because I
it's about noticed kicking ass. That's
yeah, because I know that I got this really like, oh, somebody's in trouble. I'm going to help them. I'm going to save them or something like that. But that gets me into trouble as well.
Yes, absolutely. You're in trouble if you can't save them. You're in trouble if you drown trying to save them. You're in trouble if after they're saved, they're not appreciative. They don't care. In fact, if you're trying to save a drowning man, more than likely he will try to drown you in order to save himself. That's why lifeguards have to have special training. You just can't go jump in the water to save somebody. He's going to drown you. And that's what happens to a lot of meditation teachers. They get drowned under the students. So the question then is, how can we convince people that they're going to have to practice this stuff on their own? That I can cheer you up for the moment. But you're going to have to cheer yourself up over and over and over again until you finally figure out that you can do it. You actually can save yourself. You can learn to swim. And in fact, that's a really good thing to use is to begin, if you're drowning, instead of floundering and hoping and yelling, best thing to do is to learn to swim right then. This is the time. Now's the time to learn to swim. So this is also true about Anapanasati. When you sit down, it's time to learn to swim. It's time to learn to change your own mind, that you can cheer yourself up. You can do it. You can practice it. And then you get uncheered up because of a negative thought. Never mind, start again. Come back and cheer yourself up again. Over and over and over and over again until you finally figure out that you can do it. And that leads us then, actually, all along, there has been a third kind of doubt. And this is the doubt that is most famous in the suttas, the third kind of doubt, which is doubt about, is it even possible? And this is where the Eightfold Noble Path and the Four Noble Truths comes in, is to prove to us that we can do it. And we've got the method to do it. And when we begin to figure out, in fact, when we do figure out for sure that we can do it, then this is actually when we're on the path now. Until then, nobody's really on the path. They're in the hospital. They're sitting on the side of the road trying to thumb a ride. That in fact, in the Sutta number 48, in the Kansambian Sutta, there is a passage where the Buddha says, first off, he spends a couple of paragraphs defining the hindrances, defining what an obstruction to the mind is. And then he comes with this key point, and that is that the student who knows absolutely knows that no matter how obstructed the mind gets, no matter what hindrances beset us, no matter what situation we get ourselves into, we can come out of that state of mind and see how things actually really are. We can see the truth. We can see reality no matter what. And then the Buddha says, this is the very first knowledge. The very first knowledge is that no matter what, I can clean my mind back out. I am the winner. I am the champion of my own life. I can fix what's broken. And mostly what's broken is the mentality that things are broken. And when I fix that mentality to see that things are not broken, then I can come to reality as it is. The Buddha says that this is the first step on the path, the first knowledge, the first point. He says also that this is noble, that it is supramundane, it's above the world. And above all, this is not the mentality that ordinary people have. Most ordinary people are losers in the sense that they think that they can't do it themselves. And this step here is the step that you have solid knowledge, that you know that you can do it. You're the champion now. So that's when we actually practice enough to recognize that we can do the Buddha's path, and then we are free from that doubt about what to do in life. In other words, our life's plan is set for us, because we know that the Eightfold Noble Path is the path of the way that we're going to live our lives, and I can live up to it myself. This is the path. The path is the path of no more doubt, no more worry. We are on top of the world. We've got it made. That doesn't mean you're perfect, but it does mean that when you mess up, you can say, hot dog, I can fix that. I can fix it. I can harm people and then I can get over it. And when we have that, we stop looking for love in all the wrong places. We take care of ourselves instead. And let us say a priest who has come to that point, we can put this in Christian language, when he knows that his path to heaven is absolutely guaranteed because he knows how to do it, he's not going to be looking for a pleasure with the altar boys. The sexuality and sensuality is actually the consolation prize for the loser's mentality. I can't be happy, but at least I can get laid. But when you are happy, you don't need to get laid. You're already okay. This is why people talk about the practice of Anapanasati and the bliss that one gets from that solid, rock-solid knowledge that you know that you're on top of your own world. It's better than sex. Sex is temporary. Sex is a lot of work. I mean, look how much money is spent on sexuality. How many people go to the gym? How many people buy automobiles? How many people buy clothing? I mean, the makeup and the shoes and the bags and all of this kind of stuff is all about sensuality, because we want to be loved and we're trying to find people to love us because we don't know how to not need to be loved. We don't need love. I'm okay. I don't need to be loved. The gold that's in the mine, or let us say the big bar of gold, not bar, but that strange-shaped object that's laying in the creek, that's solid gold, he doesn't need to be found in order to be gold. It's already gold. And that's the way that you're going to begin to have your own mentality is that you can become that alchemist. You can, in fact, turn your life from the crap that you find yourself in into solid gold. You are gold. As the Zen master says, you're already enlightened. Just sit there. You don't need anything. You're already okay. It's the attitude that we need something, that we're not okay, which is just an attitude, is what causes all the gripe and the troubles of the world. If my little square inch of heaven is good enough, then I do not have to go invade Ukraine.
Mm-hmm.
You can see that, in fact, people who need to invade Ukraine are really in a state of deprivation. People who need to rob the bank, the people who need to go to the brothel, the people who need to go to the hoochie-coochie show, even the performers, they are in a state of deprivation. They're deprived, and they know it, and they recognize that they need something. When we all get to the point of recognizing everybody's in that same boat, that's big it. Mahayana boat is not taking us where we need to go. We need to get out of that big boat and start rowing. Rowing wholesome thoughts, one after another. I can make it here. I'm on my way. I've got my path to life. I can do it. So that's the real point is that can we change our attitude from the attitude of I need help, I need lead, I need guns, I need money into I don't need anything. I'm already okay. I got everything I need. That's an attitude change, the attitude of a winner. Go ahead.
No, it's very interesting because I was contemplating something similar today. To put it short, I had a very intense craving. Be it just sensual, like whether it be food or sex or whatever. And I catch myself saying, I don't need this. I guess it's very hard. Like I really want to be free from those things. But sometimes it grasps me tightly. I'm not sure.
No, it does not grasp you tightly. You're the one who's grasping it tightly, hoping to get something out of it.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you for reframing it. It's so tricky how quick my mind just flip that thing around. Yeah, I do. I will say I want it so badly. I think just recognizing that is already helping, right? Just recognizing I'm the one who's grasping on it very tightly. Yes. Okay. That's all I want to ask, actually.
But this is what I'm looking for is the joy of the smiles and the nods of the head and people begin to say, you know, I can do it on my own. I can do this.
Yes.
Watch me practice. Watch me fall down and get up again and never mind, start again. I can do this. That's the attitude that we have to take on. It's all about attitude. The attitude of I'm okay. And because I'm really okay, everything else is okay too. I'm okay, you're okay. Everything is hunky-dory. No problems anywhere.
Yes.
Paul, do you have a comment?
You know what? This is a great subject. I mean, this is like really heavy.
It's light. That's the whole point. You've been making it heavy all of this time. It's not heavy at all. Just drop all of that crap, and now you're on top of your world.
Yeah. No, I don't have a comment, really.
Annette, how about you? Are you there?
Yeah, yes, definitely. I also don't have a comment yet, Tamarata, but I find this very interesting.
How about enlightening? How about waking up? How about you're on top of it all? Interesting is a word that victims use. Someday I'll be at Prince. So anyway, it's interesting. Go ahead, I'm listening.
Yeah, nothing, Damaral. I don't have any more comment right now, but I find the topic enlightening.
Yes. Yeah. How about you, Carl? What do you think?
Yeah, it's great. Really fantastic topic. What was the word you mentioned? Was it asava? The Pali word?
I don't remember.
Okay.
I think it was achiva. Achiva?
Achiva. Achiva. Ignorance, not knowing.
All right.
Thinking we know the solution. Thinking that, okay, so part of the achiva is that I need help. That's not just ignorance, that's delusional. But you don't need any help.
That's great.
Ajiva. It actually is based upon either you could use the term knowing not or not knowing. And I choose the not knowing part. Not knowing is regular ignorance, but knowing not or knowing wrongly, that's the problem. We think what we know, and when in fact we don't. We're deluded. For instance, we think that the path to happiness, the priest thinks that the path to happiness is the altar boy. Where in fact any wise person around will say that's really dangerous.
Looking for love in all the wrong places, huh?
And looking for love in all the wrong places is the delusion that we're all in, ajiva.
Ah, right. That's fantastic.
Knowing wrongly. Thomas, you joined us very late.
Got to turn on your microphone, Thomas.
Oh, there you go. Sorry. Did I get the wrong time?
Yes, yeah. You got the wrong time. We started an hour ago.
Oh, sorry. I thought it was 10 o'clock UK time.
Well, I bet you changed your clock, didn't you?
Ah, okay. I hear you. Yeah, that's probably why.
In Thailand, they don't change clocks.
Right. I just looked at some old, I found out about you and about this Sangha through something written online, and it said 10 a.m. UK time. So then I checked what time it is at the moment in the UK, and it's 10 a.m. So anyway.
Yeah, I think it's 4 p.m. Thai time, because they don't change the clock.
All right. I'll go by Thai time next time.
All right. So, David. Ensconced at Wat Khao Tum. What do you think? Are you up to it? Are you up to the task?
Oh, yeah. You did say that people who go to Wats or monasteries or places like those are people that don't think they're in control of their life and don't feel on top of their life. So where does someone like that go then?
Well, you're going to the right place. You're just doing the wrong thing there. Then in fact, what the Wats are really good at is doing nothing. I will say this though. And that is that the hospital is for sick people, whether they're patients, family, doctors, nurses, staff, everybody at the hospital is sick. If you're not sick, you don't need to be in the hospital. So
where would someone who is not sick go then?
Actually, that's kind of a funny question, because if you're not sick, you don't go to the hospital. But if you're already in the morgue, why not just hang out there? Because there's no place to go. The point, though, is that if you are sick, you got to be careful, because other sick people are going to make you more sick using you to save themselves. And if you're not sick, you can, let us say, have fun with the toys, all of those broken people. And this is part of the reason why the Arahats, the real ones, are generally in the back of the Wat. They're generally in seclusion. And they'll come out from time to time to answer a few questions, knowing that the people who are asking them questions are there to get the guru to do their jobs for them. That in fact, Zen is quite famous. Some of the Zen schools are quite famous for the Rishi, the old master, to give always just one-liners. He doesn't sit to describe what's going on. In fact, he'll ask questions. And in fact, the questions are really easy to answer, but when they're really hard to answer, because the students don't know how to answer questions, they call it a koan. And in fact, you've heard of the koan of the sound of one hand clapping. All you have to do is just rephrase that to the sound of one mouth yapping. That we're always trying to hit something with our hand. We're out there trying to find another hand to clap with. We don't need to do that. And so Zen masters, like, for instance, the story that I told about the Zen master, he slams the door in the face of the student to help teach the point that you're on your own. You don't need the teacher to hold the door for you. So why go to the Wat is to just hang out. To go to the Wat is to go do nothing. And yet, Pat's been talking. Michael and I were just had a long call with Kat about all these German monks who have gone to stay at the Wat in Udon Thani. Because there's a famous German teacher there, Achan Martin, and they're all into the austerities. They have to eat their food exactly correctly. They have to do everything perfectly. They have to do all of these austerities. And I've been telling Kat, hey, man, what you need to do is to learn to hang out. That those guys are doing all of those chores because they want something out of them. And basically what they want is mastery. They want to be able to conquer and master those austerities so that they can prove to themselves that they are the master. Well, we're doing that in a much easier going way. That's kind of like in martial arts. You have the hard method of punching and boxing and kicking and all of that. And then you have the jujitsu. All you have to do is just get out of your own way. And that's what we're practicing with Anapanasati, is to just get out of our own way, to drop those unwholesome thoughts and come to our own mastery directly. That's all the practice is to come out of our victimhood, come out of needing stuff. And I was pointing out that everybody who goes to the Wat is in a state of need, And all they have to do is just change their mind, to train their mind that they're already at the place they need to be. Just sit down and have fun. Just sit down and enjoy your life. You're already arrived. You don't have to do the austerities. You don't have to suck up to some big monk or do a lot of work or anything. That you can begin to do nothing and enjoy doing it. Like I said, hospitals like Watts are for sick people. They're not for the health. But if you can get healthy while you're at the hospital, you have a choice. Are you going to come or go? And in fact, I have been known to say that I've retired several times. That in fact, I retired from life to become a monk. But that was his own world. I got out of the world becoming a monk. And then I found out that the world of monks is another world, because it's full of monks that are needing things. And so I retired from that too. And now I don't need nothing.
Good on you. I find it so interesting about the, you know, this idea. It's so true. You can only do it yourself. And then like you're saying, how you relax into it.
Just relax into being the boss. There's two kinds of bosses, you could say two kinds of leaders. Those that lead by beating their people, and those who just go their own way and people kind of follow along behind them because they're the ones who are looking for a guru. The trick is, don't look back. Don't need them. Don't need anybody. Don't need anything. You're already okay. But in our society, we have been taught just the other way around. We were born victims, and we remain victims until we make a choice. But that choice has to be made over and over and over and over again until it becomes really rock solid. We have to practice. Michael, do you have anything to say?
Stay golden, y'all. And everyone here, if you haven't, please go check out the opensanghafoundation.org website. Make an account, play around with it. And if you'd like to volunteer for our Sangha, there's multiple opportunities to do that as well. Just get in contact with me. Thank you.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for making that statement. We could use some happy help.
Yeah, anybody? Definitely. I'm so surprised because so popular, yet, you know, we've only got 9 participants over here in the UK. And gosh, I'm amazed that there's not more people involved. We need more people.
Yes, I'm not. But anyway, I would appreciate if you could. Basically, what we're doing right now is vetting data. That we've got the name of the place. And we've got some information about everybody. We've got an address. We've got an email for some. We've got a website for some. And what we need to do is to take the data that we have and flush it out. Go find a photo. Go find a website. Go find an email. Go find a YouTube video. Go, you know, get the address, get to Facebook, get an Instagram. The more data that we can collect about each one of our, we've got actually about 4,000 4,000 places. We've got wats and temples all over the world. Hundreds and hundreds of Thai and Lao and Cambodian temples in the United States. And many of them don't have websites. Actually, what's so slow about it is that the data that we're looking for doesn't exist. If the data was already there, if all of these wats, for instance, had a website and a Facebook and an email and videos, then it takes only a couple of 3 minutes. But sometimes the emails are obscure. You have to look on every page of every of the website if they've got one, and things like this. And so that's what we're doing, is getting as much information about as many places as we can. Why do we want to do that? It's because we want it to be universal. Basically, this site can be the go-to place for anybody who's looking for anything Buddha-wise. This is, in fact, this tape would be, this video would be a good one to put on there.
Okay, so what Wat is near Hereford in the UK?
Why don't you call me or Michael, and we'll help you through that. But on our website, what you would do is basically put in information about the closest city to you. Look for that city. We also, eventually what we're going to do, and we've got about half of them now, there is actually a Google map that has about half of our data on it already. And so you can just hone right in on that map down to that locality, and it's going to have all of these places that are there.
Yeah, cool. Because it's funny, I moved up to Hereford, and they got a big Goenka center over here, one of his international ones and local ones here in Hereford. And, you know, that was one of the reasons I moved up here. But, you know, it's like, I like Thai forest, and
there's a lot of Thai forest places in England.
All over the island.
Mm-hmm. Do you know about Hamel Hampstead? What Amaravati?
Yes, Amaravati. Yes, I was there once. Yes. Yes, I'd love to go there again. Yeah.
Good place. So that's what we're doing, is we're collecting as much information as we can. And so you can actually go on the website right now and see what we have already. We've got a lot of places with addresses. So you can do the search and find out what's in that neighborhood.
Excellent. And that's Open Sangha, is it?
Open Sangha Foundation, yes. .org.
Okay. .org. All right.
Michael, why don't you post a link to it again right here on this channel?
Sure.
Also, I invite everybody to join because of security reasons and because of the internet and all of that kind of stuff, the best information is hidden, and you have to log in. If you log in, then everything is available to you. But when you do log in, I invite you to help us out by putting all of your data in. Put your email and your phone and your address and your practice and all of that kind of stuff. There it is.
Got it.
Just click on that link, and that'll take you right to the website. Then, in fact, to take one more minute, let me describe it like this. We're looking for people who know nothing about Buddhism to help them get started. We're looking for people who already are into Buddhism and are looking for a teacher. We've got teachers available on call. for those who are wanting to become a teacher, we're going to have a teacher training program. For those who are really ready to go, we have hundreds of watts for people to move into, as well as ways to move in. And so that's, we've got it for, you know, all levels. For those who want to sit back and help donate, for people who, because we're going to be supporting, in fact, we're supporting people as we speak. There's on the About page at the bottom of it, we have both those who are being supported already. We've got a lot of monks that are already monks that have been receiving support from Open Sangha Foundation. As many of them has helped them become monks. So Cad, by the way, is just about ready to ordain. David has been ordained and he's still hanging out in the Watt. Michael's thinking about giving it a go. Kima Situ is living on the Isle of Man, and I helped him while he was here in Bangkok to keep him in the robes. Eric is in Laos. He's already ordained. So we have a number of people who are ordained, but we're also mostly interested in helping people to start moving into the Watts wherever they are locally. Like you're asking a question about where's something local for you. I would like to be able to help you to move in, to actually move into the place.
I'd love to, man. I'd love to move into a Watt. Maybe Amravati might be the place.
It might be. But in fact, we could put you in touch with Jesus, because Jesus has spent quite a lot of time at Amravati.
All right, yeah.
And he kind of moves around Europe going from Watt to Watt. I think right now he's in one Watt in Portugal someplace.
Cool.
So this is what we're into. We're into helping people connect with all those other people who are looking to get connections. And in a way, we're helping people to look for love in, you know, kind of the right places. Until they can figure out that that, too, is something that they, you know, it's actually to facilitate people practicing correctly. Because the world out there, if you spend, you know, 10, 15 minutes or an hour a day practicing correctly and then spend the other 23 hours out in the world, then it's kind of hard to practice well. But if you're around other people who are practicing correctly, they greatly benefit one another.
Yeah.
It's called Sangha, by the way. That's what Sangha is really all about. Sangha is the Buddha's word for hospital.
Yeah.
So we're on our own?
You're on your own, but go find other people who know that too, because people who are on their own can work together.
Yeah.
You know what? I love that Gurdjieff thing. That he always said that there were three lines of work. You've got your individual work. You've got your work with your friends, your sangha, and you've got the work with the teaching, or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And I totally see that. So much.
Well, I'm really happy that you're all here. I consider each one of you a good friend. Thank you. So let's go ahead and finish the call now. And enjoy logging on. I would like to see each one of you sign up.
Thank you, Damarato.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for your lessons.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll see you later.
Have a good one.